Welcome to another edition of the Radio Book Club, a collaboration between KGNU Community Radio and the Boulder Bookstore. As always, I'm joined in the studio by my co-host, Arsene Kashkashian, head buyer of the bookstore. Good morning.
Wonderful to be here, Maeve.
Well, I'm thrilled to be here because one of my favourite writers is in the studio, and I can't believe we're welcoming Geraldine Brooks to KGNU. Great to have you with us.
Great to be here.
Now, we have so many books to choose from of Geraldine's work, but the latest one is The Secret Chord. Tell us a little bit about it and why this has been this month's selection.
Well, you know, when I saw Geraldine was coming to town, I thought, wow, wouldn't it be amazing to be able to talk to her on the radio? So I jumped at the opportunity. And this is her latest book, as you said, and it's really the retelling of the King David story. And I thought that would be a fascinating story. And, you know, when it was published a year ago or so, because it's in paperback now, but as we lead up to this election, reading about the kings and their behavior, I felt was very interesting.
It struck me that not much has changed when it comes to certain things, but we'll get into that a little bit. But Geraldine Brooks, it is such an honour to have you here. And as Arsene said, it's the retelling of the King David story. I know you are famous for retelling or to dipping into history in many different ways, in a very in-depth way in your books. But why King David? Talk about history. This is as historical as you can get.
This was quite a bit deeper down in the pot than I usually go, to be honest. And I'm not sure I understood what I was quite getting into when you're writing about a past that is so distant. You know, talking Second Iron Age Israel, and I tried to ground the story as much as I could in the material realities of the time. But I was led to it, I guess, by my son when he was 9 years old. He took the unusual decision for a little boy that the one musical instrument he really wanted to play was the classical harp. And, you know, could he have picked a more inconvenient one? I don't think so. But it was a lovely choice because you can't make a bad sound on the harp, so we didn't have to, you know, wear earmuffs when he was practicing. And it was watching him dwarfed by this huge instrument when he was still quite small that set me to thinking about the other boy harpist. And I realized I didn't know much about the David story except the greatest hits, you know, David and Goliath and David and Bathsheba. And then when I started reading the story, I realized that everything happened to David. His life is told from early childhood to extreme old age, and it is just packed with every kind of emotional experience a human being can have, the best and the worst. And so I was very attracted to looking at maybe the first man in full that we're introduced to in history.
When you tell the story, how much do you assume that your readers know, or did not come into play for you, or did you think about that? You know, for some people, it's such a well-known story, but for other people, they're not really that versed in the Bible.
Yeah, you know, I think you have to sort of set that aside, and if anything, I wanted to reintroduce these characters to people in an unfamiliar way. So I used the Hebrew names from the Hebrew scriptures rather than the more familiar ones that we have from the King James Bible, because I didn't want people to think, oh yeah, I know this from Sunday school. I wanted them to approach it in a fresher way. And I also wanted to expunge any Cecil B. DeMille Bible epics or, you know, Renaissance art where these Second Iron Age guys are put into medieval dress or they're put into Hollywood, you know, not really relevant to anything dress. And so that was what I set out to do. And I think, you know, people who are very, you know, Bible believing do know the scriptures very well, but there's a lot that's unsaid in this story. There are brilliant incidents that go by in a flash and characters who are sketched quite brilliantly, but very briefly. And so I just wanted to let the story breathe more and to stand back and say what else might have happened here that they didn't have time to tell us.
Well, the character you really bring to life is Nathan, the narrator who's the prophet. And what an interesting way to tell the story. He's with David from the time David's in his 20s, and he ends up interviewing people to find out what David's life was like before he had met David. How did you hit upon telling the story from the prophet's point of view?
Well, I always like to write in a first-person narrative because I think it brings the story to the reader much more directly. And I really wasn't sure who should tell this story. And then I came across two references in the Book of Chronicles that both say in different words, essentially, that the life of David is told in the book of Nathan the prophet. But hello, we don't have the book of Nathan. It's not part of the scriptures. It's been lost or never found. And then when you look at who Nathan is in the story that we do have in the books of Samuel, he's the ferocious truth teller who's the only one who's brave enough to confront the king and tell him when he's been a moral failure. And I thought, wow, if we had this book written by this ferociously brave truth teller, what would we know differently about David?
Yeah, it's a fascinating insight into him. And he's with David very close. And David takes the truth from him because David understands that it's God can speak through him, even though most of the time God is not speaking through him. That was interesting duality, that sometimes he almost goes like into a trance and speaks God's word.
Well, he thinks he does. You know, and I've left it a little bit open for the reader to say, well, is this only what he thinks? So some other characters take a more jaundiced view of him and think he's just playing for power.
Right, but David believes him.
David absolutely believes him. And the interesting thing about David as a character and what I think really sets him apart from other flawed leaders that we may have today is that when he's confronted with the truth, he accepts it and then he admits it and then he tries to set it straight, tries to atone for what he's done. And interestingly, he doesn't drive Nathan off or have him thrown in the slammer for telling him the truth. He draws him closer, and it's Nathan that he's relying on at the end of his life to make sure that the succession goes the right way.
Mm-hmm. When you were writing, like you mentioned earlier, there's the greatest hits, and that's what people know. But when you write towards those moments, whether it's David and Goliath's story, whether it's the story of Absalom being killed, or you know, some of those greatest hits that people do know, how did you approach those scenes? Because it feels like to me as a reader that as a writer, you'd have some added pressure to either, you don't want to overplay it, but at the same time, everybody's reading for this scene, you know?
Well, quite. And so I spent a lot of time thinking about those scenes in particular. And I'm a novelist who likes to ground my work in as much fact as I can find. So with David and Goliath, I wanted to know what was really going on there. So I went back to archaeological and historical sources. What was life like? And I think we have a kind of a Hollywood image of two great big armies facing off against each other in the Valley of Elah. But that's almost certainly not how it went down, because if you look at the facts, the entire population of that region, and this includes what's now Israel, Syria, and, you know, much of, a little bit of Jordan as well, 45,000 people was the entire population. So you're not going to have vast standing armies. And who was fighting whom there? So the enemy of the Hebrew tribes, and the Hebrew tribes were basically simple farmers and herders, and they were beset by the more sophisticated city-dwelling people from the Mediterranean coast, the Philistines. And those Philistines had access to better weapons, and the Hebrew tribes didn't have any access to iron. So they were basically, technology was the advantage of the enemy. And so if you think about it like that, and the one thing that they tell you in the David and Goliath story is a great deal of detail about the armor that Goliath was wearing. So he must have seemed like a giant, partly because he was wearing armor that the like of which they'd never seen before, imported from more sophisticated places. And then I thought, well, how would David have defeated him? Well, by not engaging him in hand-to-hand combat, by keeping his distance so that the technological advantage could be wiped out.
We're speaking with bestselling author Geraldine Brooks about her latest book, The Secret Chord, which is a retelling of the story of King David. Geraldine has written many, many books, including the Pulitzer Prize winning book, March, some other books, Caleb's Crossing, and The Year of Wonders. That was the first book of yours that I read, and I never thought I'd be so engaged by a book about plague. And I didn't think I'd be so engaged about a story that I thought I knew. And as you said, a lot of people are familiar with the greatest hits of King David, David and Goliath. That was the only thing I actually knew about King David. And so given that this, you know, the Bible is the main source of this, I mean, you said you went through some archaeological research as well, but how else can you research a character that goes so far back that has the story in the ultimate book, the Bible?
So I wanted to get as close to his experiences as possible. So I took my youngest son, who was 10 at the time, and we went off to Israel together. I love to exploit my kids as research assistants because they have this wonderful fresh view of things, and they ask all these wonderful questions that wouldn't occur to us in our jaded state. And so we decided we'd visit all the places associated with David and do some of the things that he might have done, not the adultery and murder, but things like herding sheep. So we spent an afternoon herding sheep, and I watched my 10-year-old, how he learned what he needed to know in order to get the flock to do what he wanted to do. And I thought it's interesting because so many leaders of the Hebrew tribes start off as shepherds. So I was interested in what is it about this that makes it such a good entry-level position for future CEOs of Israel. And I did learn that, you know, you have to understand the animal. And I think all leaders have to understand those that they're trying to lead in order to get the best performance out of them.
So speaking of adultery and murder, let's talk about that. I mean, David really is a murderous leader. I mean, he has to go into these little villages, especially when he's exiled, and he's got to kill everybody in them, you know, and when, during his raids. And then I guess let's start with that, and then we can move to adultery.
Yeah, no, I mean, he is definitely a guy who will do what he believes is necessary to fulfill his destiny. And in one of the many reversals of his long life story, he had been taken up by the royal family and was a great pet of King Saul, and then Saul turns against him and he has to flee for his life, and the only place he can be safe and out of Saul's reach is essentially as a traitor working for those very Philistines who are the enemies of the Hebrews. And so he's very tricky. He pretends he's, you know, in the service of King Achish, and then it turns out that he's really double dealing, and he to hide what he's doing, he has to kill a lot of innocent people. So yeah, in our terms, he's a war criminal.
And then he doesn't hesitate to take, you know, the wives, especially later in the book. A lot of them are taken as political maneuvers to solidify his leadership, but the main one, Bathsheba, that's the wife of one of his commanders, and he basically rapes her, and this ends up being really the driving force of the second half of the book.
Well, it's the turning point of his life. I think, you know, you see him as this middle-aged guy who, for the first time in his life, has been told he can't lead his troops to battle because he almost got killed the last time he did. And so he's frustrated and feeling perhaps in doubt about his manhood. And he sees this very beautiful woman and takes her. And if you read all the male commentary on this incident, they all say she was a seductress. Well, no, I'm totally not buying that. This young woman, and we know she was young because she has no children with her husband Uriah, who's away fighting David's battles for him. And she's taken, ordered to the king's bedroom. Does she have any choice in this? I think not. And then, of course, she's pregnant, and the crime for the punishment for adultery is stoning to death. So she's in a terrible situation, and David's is not much better because it's not a good look to be stealing the wife of your loyal soldier. So this causes him to commit a very great crime, which is to essentially have her husband Uriah killed. And that's the crime that Nathan confronts him about.
Yeah, I mean, and what's interesting about David is, in some ways, in many ways, he's so devout. And he creates this music where he's singing to God. And
the Psalms, don't forget the Psalms. He's such a poet. And I really, it's fascinating because the Bible tells us that David wrote a number of the Psalms, most of them. And there's a tremendous amount of biographical detail in them. So I think that, you know, there's something to that. And it's really astonishing that you can hear the voice of somebody who lived 3,000 years ago.
So you have that devoutness, but then you have this sinning, this man who can't live up to, you know, that life in a way. So it's all embodied in this one person.
I think, you know, I thought a lot about George R.R. Martin and Game of Thrones and the wonderful line that Cersei has that when you play the Game of Thrones, you win or you die. And I think that, you know, this is probably the original Game of Thrones story.
So there's a part of the book I was hoping you would read, and this involves kind of the beautiful things that he does, the music that he's brought to the city.
Yes, well, the Bible actually has several references to the fact that he brought choirs of singing men and singing women, which is unusual at that time in the Middle East, and musicians of all kinds. So he really brought these, you know, basically unsophisticated Hebrew tribes together and created a cultured civilization out of them. And that's the other side of him. And I also don't want to lose sight of the fact that even though he did some very brutal things, he was also a man who loved hugely. I mean, almost to a fault. He just loves the people around him so much.
Well, he certainly loved his sons to a fault.
Yes.
You know, he forgave them everything. He couldn't hold them accountable.
Even when
for
they
anything.
Were trying to kill him. Yeah.
Yeah. So let me have you read just the end. And this is, we're actually going to have Geraldine read the very end of the book, which we've never done before, but this is King David pretty much on his deathbed as Solomon is being anointed king.
Yeah, he's had to make a decision to give the throne to his younger son, Solomon, because the older brothers are morally lost and incapable of keeping the kingdom together. And so Bathsheba asks him to do it because it's her son, and Nathan is the one who makes it happen. So Nathan has gone with the priest to anoint Solomon. There, in the palace, in the king's bedchamber, David heaved himself upright as he heard the cries of acclamation, the blasts of the shofars. He reached for Bathsheba, drew her close and kissed her. Then he lay back on the soft bank of pillows that Avishag had arranged to cradle his wasted body. As sometimes happened, there was a moment of respite from the storm of tremors. The ache stilled. David lay quietly, listening. This is what he heard. All the musicians he had brought to the city, all the singing men and women, all the children who had grown up with instruments in their hands and songs on their lips, his own music, his gift to the people, now returned to him in magnificent abundance. He had made of his city an accidental choir, an unintended orchestra. The surge of sound rose and swelled. Then, for a long moment, all the notes came together, all the music of the heavens and the earth, combining at last into one sustained, sublime, entirely glorious chord.
That's beautiful. You know, I was reading the book, and, you know, he plays the harp a lot. He's a poet, you know, and he sings. He's got a beautiful singing voice. I almost thought, could you have written like a rock and roll kind of biography of him? Him as musician with this king stuff off on the side, you know, because he's playing music his entire life, really.
Well, that's a great idea. Somebody should definitely do that. I mean, I didn't read the other books about David while I was writing this because I didn't want to be too influenced by them. But Joseph Heller has a hilarious take on David called God Knows, and it's all written from David's deathbed, and he comes to completely different conclusions about who are the goodies and the baddies in the story than I did, but it really is so funny.
We're speaking with bestselling author Geraldine Brooks this morning on KGNU on our Radio Book Club, a collaboration with KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran. My co-host, as always, is Arsene Kashkashian of the Boulder Bookstore. And this month, we've been reading The Secret Chord by Geraldine Brooks, a retelling of the story of King David. And as you said at the beginning, Geraldine, you kind of knew some of the greatest hits about this King David, David and Goliath. And I think a lot of people will find glimmers of recognition, because there's so much that endures today and still so many references to the King David story. You know, the shining city on the hill, you know, Reagan said that, the David and Goliath analogy is used all the time now in politics.
And sport, and business. It's such a cliche. It's almost become, you know, tiresome to hear it.
But I mean, it seems like there really is so much of the King David story that is still in modern culture today, and yet obviously so much that's not known.
Well, I think there are so many wonderful characters that people don't know about, and some of the other wives, fascinating stories. I think the story of David and his first wife, Michal, who's the princess, the daughter of King Saul, who actually chooses him, which is very unusual for a woman in the Bible, where, let's face it, women don't usually get too much ink. They're lucky if they get a first name. Lot's wife, Gladys. But we know a lot about David's wives, and Michal chooses him and loves him passionately. And then, because of the things that happen to her when she chooses her love for David over her father, and then has to pay a terrible price.
But what was interesting to me was her brother's relationship with David.
Well, Yonatan, or Jonathan, as he's more familiarly known. The Bible says that this love was so great that their souls were knit together, and that Jonathan, who was older and an established commander in the army at the time, David is still a nebbish in the sheepfold, basically sponsors David, takes him up, teaches him everything he knows, gives him his own clothing, his weapons, everything, and then gives him his inheritance, says, you will be king and I will be second to you. So this is an extraordinary relationship. And I tried to think about what that was like for Michal, to have this great love of her brother and David, and it's almost as if there's three people in that marriage. And in the end, her love turns to the most corrosive hatred, and she's able to wound David as only somebody who knows a person intimately can do.
But you really write about the romance of the relationship between Jonathan and David. How is it framed in the Bible? I have to say, I haven't read it, so I don't like the Bible version.
So, you know, what I go to a small synagogue where our tradition is you take the scripture and you squeeze the juice out of every word of it, and you hold it up to the light and you move it around in the light of your own lived experience. And when I read the words in this biblical text describing this relationship, and when Yonatan dies and David writes this poem of lament for him, he says, my brother Yonatan, your love to me was wonderful, more wonderful than the love of woman. So to me, with my lived experience, the only way to interpret that is as a full relationship.
Well, I think that's how most people seem to see it now. I mean, but that's a more modern reading. I think, going back to Oscar Wilde, he referenced that actually.
Well, yeah,
in his lifetime.
A lot of people find that a very controversial and confronting interpretation, but that's the only one. I would have had to twist myself into a pretzel to come up with any other interpretation of the relationship. And I think you have to listen to your heart. I mean, otherwise there's no, to me, there's very little point in the scriptures if they don't speak into our experience as we live today.
Mm-hmm. I was so glad to read about the wives. And as you said, so often in the Bible, they don't even get named, never mind a backstory where somebody writes about their emotions, and particularly what happened with Bathsheba, that it was named as rape, because as you said, she's always been framed as a seductress. And even Nathan, the prophet, he finally hears her story and he has this realization. You know, and it seems like even back then, back to the beginning of time, rape was all the time used, you know, as part of war and as a war crime. Not much
and
has changed.
And an expression of power. You know, I do think that I was influenced writing this book by the fact that I spent 10 years Before I turned to fiction writing, I was a journalist and I was correspondent for the Wall Street Journal in the Middle East. And I developed a particular interest in the lives of the women of the region and how women in countries that give them no public power and very few rights, yet nevertheless manage to negotiate their lives quite brilliantly and influence the decision making so that they can make a better choice in marriage, perhaps, or secure the future for their kids. And you learn that private power is very real, even though it's not always obvious. And so I thought about women. I had spent time with women like Ayatollah Khomeini's wife, who very few people know much about, but she was an incredibly influential person in Iran, and Queen Noor of Jordan, and, you know, just other women who have less exalted positions, but who still manage to duck and weave and make their lives work out. And so I thought about them as I was trying to recreate the stories of David's wives.
And also David's mother, who I don't think is named in the Bible.
She's not, but she's a very, she's discussed quite a bit in the Talmud. And so I took the Talmudic references to her to build a story about her.
You brought her to life. And what I found interesting was, you know, the two things in the second half part of his life are, is the rape that he commits. And it's also the rape that his son of his daughter, it's a sin of omission on his part. He doesn't do anything about it. And so this violence against women ends up really framing his life.
And, you know, destroying it to a certain extent. It tears his family apart. It tears, it's the direct result is the death of his first son with Bathsheba. You know, his failure to act against his oldest son, Amnon, in the rape of his half-sister Tamar leaves the next son, Avshalom, to take that revenge instead of the justice that his father should have effected. So he kills his brother. So you end up with fratricide. And, you know, it's morally squalid, but the redeeming thing about David is that he sees his errors and he tries to atone as best he can for them. Yeah. And he accepts that he will have to suffer terrible consequences.
Yeah, and that's what makes him so unique. And then even when his son rises up against him and his son is killed, he is just distraught that his son has been killed. It's not like
he's not a strategic thinker at that point. He is so bereft about Avshalom being killed quite righteously by his general that he blows up one of the key relationships in his life, which was his relationship with the general who's known in the King James Bible as Joab and who in Hebrew as Yoav. And he can't forgive Yoav for his actions.
A lot of times they say historical works, either novels or nonfiction, often reflect the time they're written in. When you look at your work with the King David, do you see that? Or are you able to kind of think of, like, why is this the moment that this is the right book in some ways?
I didn't go into it thinking that, but as I was researching it, I was very much struck by how the human heart doesn't change and human weaknesses remain constant. I was researching this book when I heard about David Petraeus, who was the commander of the U.S. forces in northern Iraq, and his soldiers used to jokingly call him King David. And of course, as we know, he blew up his career having committed adultery with his biographer. So things don't change.
No, and what we're seeing in the news every day right now is unbelievable with what power men with power and how they abuse that power. And of course we don't see the contrition or the devoutness of the king. We don't see the other side of it. The positive side of King David is not coming out.
That is 100% and absolutely true.
We've been speaking with best-selling author Geraldine Brooks this morning here on our Radio Book Club. Her latest book is The Secret Chord, and I hope you've been reading along with us. If not, of course, you can go check it out. And don't forget to find our podcast on iTunes as well. As always, my co-host is Arsen Kashkashian with the Boulder Bookstore. Geraldine Brooks, it's been a delight. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Maeve, for having me.
As always, at the end of the show, we announce our next month selection. And coming up on November 17th, we are going to hear from Brad Watson. His new book is Miss Jane. Tell us a little bit about that and why we should be reading it.
Well, this is a family story that goes back to the 30s. It's a novel based on Brad Watson's great aunt, a woman named Jane, who had a genital defect that did not allow her to have sex. She never got married. She wasn't able to live the life of a woman of the time. But she went on to have a very vibrant life. And so in this novel, he kind of recreates that, and he tries to figure out the story of his great aunt. And you learn a lot about the 30s and what it was like to be in this situation at that point in time. And I think it's very well done.
Well, read along with us and tune in on November 17th at 9 a.m. and hear Brad Watson talk about his new book, Miss Jane. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. Don't forget, catch the podcast after hours at the book club on iTunes and find out more at news.kgnu.org.